www.themouthmagazine.com.
On this edition of The Mouthcast, one of the finest songwriters of recent years. With an instantly recognisable voice, shades of Roy Orbison, shades of Scott Walker, and an arch, sometimes comedic, but entirely sincere angle on romance, this is a well-known Yorkshire character who has never lost sight of his roots or of what makes him tick. From modest solo beginnings with the mini-albums Late Night Final and Low Edges, to national recognition, at last, with the albums Cole's Corner and Ladies Bridge, to the highly acclaimed and relatively psychedelic Standing at the Sky's Edge, to the more recent Hollow Meadows. Despite national acclaim and collaborations with Lisa Marie Presley, Nancy Sinatra, Elbow, Paul Weller, and many others who could be counted amongst the great and the good, he still lives in Sheffield. Probably, if you cut him open, the city's name would be written right through. My guest, the one and only Richard Hawley.
Like Owen's poetry, and wish you well, my heart of oak. When you sang Bay of Biscay, the whole world it drifted away, and the wind it sighed through the hearts of oak. I'll always be beside my heart of oak. My heart of oak.
I'm sure we'll survive.
Richard Hawley, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Nice to be here.
I mentioned Sheffield quite a bit in my introduction, and so let's begin there. You've had a successful career, acclaimed solo records, you've worked with many of the great and the good. I dare say the opportunity to leave Sheffield has come up from time to time.
Sorry, I knew that would happen, so I'll have to call her back in a bit.
All right. I think the fact that you haven't left speaks volumes, really. The place is obviously very deep in your DNA.
DNA of iPhones. Well, I should have gone offline. I'm going to do that now. Sorry, phones. The modern world, you can't escape it. There we go. We're on airplane mode now, so we're actually... We're sat next to each other. We've had takeoff.
30,000 feet.
That's here it. We can... We're just waiting for the bar to open.
So the place is obviously very deep in your DNA, but what is it about Sheffield? I know that's quite a broad question.
It's very broad. I could give you the Richard Hawley kind of tourist information thing. But is, you know, when the kind of mass exodus of artists and musicians and painters and whatever else that happened during the 80s and early 90s, a lot of people went to London, and it was quite bleak then, for obvious reasons, you know, politically and socially, you know. And I always loved it from being a kid. I mean, I've never travelled anywhere. I mean, the guitar has basically been my airline ticket. You know what I mean? I've been around the world because of it, you know. I didn't have the opportunities. When people ask me this question, I never really think about it. It's not something that I've ever had to think about personally. And in interviews, you seem to have to qualify yourself. Well, why didn't you go and live in LA and get the swimming pool and the Ferrari and all, you know, and basically it kind of got to a point when I was younger, I didn't have the opportunity. I wasn't one of the people that had an opportunity to leave, and I didn't want to. I felt like I'd been abandoning it. You know, at the time, my dad was on strike, the steelworks. You know, my family went through a lot of shit because of Margaret Thatcher and that whole era, you know, it nearly destroyed us. And I just felt always that it'd be some kind of betrayal if I left. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. A real deep betrayal, and I couldn't do it. And I've never been... I quite like going to London, you know. I'm not like a complete, you know, straw-munching sort of hick, you know. I've travelled around the world many, many times.
Although you have... There's a bowl of straw there on the
table. Oh, yeah,
next
that's
to
it, right. Yeah. And I'll have a chew in a bit. Sheffield's got 2.6 million trees, for a start. It's got 250 parks, municipal spaces, public spaces, woodland. It's the greenest city in the EU. All this stuff I found out later. I always kind of thought everywhere was like that. But you visit Manchester and there's like barely a twig. You know what I mean? There isn't. And a lot of other cities, they've got nothing like it. I mean, that's an accidental... Well, the city fathers and mothers were very generous with public spaces. Really generous. The Victorian kind of era steel magnates, even though they were industrial revolution monsters in a lot of ways, shoving kids up chimneys and, you know, kids working in factories and that. But in terms of public spaces, they were very generous. And when I was little, you used to be able to hear what I used to think was like a big giant's heartbeat. And I'd ask my dad, and he'd say, oh, that's steelworks dropping hammer at night. That's your Uncle Eric, that. And he was the bloke, one of the many men who dropped the hammer, you know. Mm. And it used to be this boom sound, and you could hear it all over the city. And it's amazing how far that heartbeat would travel, you know, and one day it stopped. And I find that really heartbreaking, you know. And yeah, all my family are there. We've lived there the holy name has been associated with the city since at least the 12th century. And I'm really glad I stayed.
So it's about, in a way, it's about knowing your place and where you fit into this line, this continuity of that habit.
History.
Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to bring my kids up there. We live in a very rootless world. And I always thought if I had kids, I'd definitely want to know where they were from and why they were here. Mm-hmm. And it helps you to know where you're going. And it has helped me. And
do you think if you had gone to London or LA and got the pull in the Ferrari, you might have gone off the rails a little bit?
Oh, 100%. Mm. Absolutely, 100%. I would have, won't be here. You know, I've had a few encounters, shall we say, with the darker side of the music industry, you know, in my time. And I was, when I was younger, it was all partying and there wasn't a darkness to it, but it ended up being a bit like that, you know. Mm. And I was a bit of an idiot, like a lot of young people are, because they've not experienced death yet. And when it happens, that's kind of, to me anyway, was when I just went, enough.
Do you mean somebody close to you in the industry? Or?
Yeah, just taking drugs and getting pissed all the time, you know. And I'd been on the dole for 10 years. By the time I actually got signed first when I was with the Long Pigs, and I was like in my mid-20s, I was 26, 25, 26. Talk about austerity. You know, I lived for 20 quid a week for 10 years. So by the time you got signed and there was all this cash, I just went crazy, you know. And I think that's a fairly understandable reaction to, for every action, there's a reaction, you know. My reaction was to go completely hurtling over a cliff on the rails, you know. But it's all right now.
What are you like? You've had a right life, taken a long ride. What a cost, and all of your life staring at white lines, reading the road signs, and oh, what a loss. sleeping late in the afternoon, playing your guitar, born under a bad sign.
I was in Sheffield a couple of days ago and having a walk around Division Street, Rare and Racy Records, all of that. The Brilliant. Bar on the corner that used to be Mr. Kite's.
Yeah, the Green Rooms are calling now. It's
yeah.
Run by Bill and Tina, some friends of mine.
Right.
Yeah, they're very nice people.
And it does feel different to any other northern city. It's solid. To me, it feels kind where Manchester can sometimes be mean. It's modest where Leeds can seem a little vulgar and grasping. How much has it changed, do you think, since you were a kid growing up there in the 70s?
Well, that's funny you mentioned that today, because we were all in the car driving over here today, and Carl, our bass player, you know, we've all lived there forever, you know, me, my entire life. And we were driving down Ecclesall Road, and it was like, hold on, that's new. That, you know, the summit springs up all the time, but I think that's the way everywhere is, isn't it? It's, everything's always constantly in flux, you know, and it's constantly changing and moving. I worry with all cities, you know, like when I was younger, I mean, I was like, oh, when I was younger, the sense of otherness seems to be disappearing, which I find a bit worrying, you know, like
uniqueness, you
know? Yeah, I call it the sense of otherness is that. In the 80s, 90s, even early 2000s, if you went to Liverpool, you'd be really aware of the fact that you were in Liverpool, you know, and it was very different.
Yep.
And Manchester. I think that to a certain degree there is still that, but it's because of corporate companies, you know, that they just buy everything up and everywhere is the same. You've always got Costa, Burger King, yada yada, you know, the whole thing. But Sheffield still seems to have little kind of shops and companies and people doing interesting things that are individuals and not kind of part of the whole chain sort of mentality, you know. And it is slowly shrinking, I mean, I've got to say, because the corporates are very powerful, you know, and they seem to be winning. But I'm the worst person to ask, because I love Sheffield, you know. And I think I've always called it the lost city, because during, you know, even back to the 60s, you know, and the 50s, if you get A&R men, record company people, you know, after the Beatles and all that, you know, they just bypass Sheffield.
Yeah.
Completely. It'd be Manchester, Liverpool, Newcastle, wherever. Nobody'd ever come there.
And yeah, it's a city that's always had an absolute wealth of talent.
Oh, yeah. It's still the same, you know, and it goes on and on and on and on. You know, there's so much, the variety of stuff as well is incredible, you know. Mm. But things have changed now, I guess, because of pull. And Arctic Monkeys, etc., maybe a little bit myself, you know, is that the train from London is just stuffed with A&R men now, you know. That might be an exaggeration.
When you were growing up there, was it a place with low horizons? Were you aware that there was a ceiling, if you like? I suppose I'm asking if by some cruel twist of fate you'd been unable to play the guitar, what you think you might be doing now. Steelworks, probably. Or not.
Not the Steelworks, because, I mean, yeah, I do. I thank my dad and my grandfather, my family, for giving me music. Because they all played and all sang, you know. And it was something I just thought was normal. And you go around to somebody else's house, one of my mates's house, they wouldn't even have a radio. So I suddenly realised we were a bit odd. Because there was music all the time and we all played, you know. So, yeah, I was very grateful for that. I still am. And now I'm passing that on to my kids, you know.
How many kids have you got?
Three, yeah. And
they all play? They're all interested in music?
No, they're all definitely massively interested in music. And two out of the three play, and one's not that bothered. But that's not a bad average, that, I reckon. And I'm not interested in them being successful or famous and all that. It's just that music is a thing that accompanies you through your life. And being able to play an instrument is something that has given me hours and, well, years of happiness, real genuine joy. I mean, I'd have been still happy playing in working men's clubs and pubs. Well, I don't know about happy, but rather than working in steelworks, because what I saw happen to the men in my family was that they worked, some of them worked for like nearly 30 years. in the steelworks. And at the end of that, they just got the rods, you know.
Mm.
And they got nothing after a lifetime of working for the man, you know. And I just vowed, because, you know, historically what happened was when Margaret Thatcher took over, a northern lad like me wasn't in her plans.
Mm.
And all the other northern boys and girls were not in her plan. Do you know what I mean? I was actually part of the problem, her problem, which was that we were, especially Sheffield, we used to have a red flag flying above the town hall, you know, Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire, you know, yeah. We were very, very militant and still are. And
at that intersection where there's the militancy, but what we were just talking about a minute ago, the kind of corporations taking over cities, do you think there's a generation coming up who are indifferent, if you like, or is indifferent the right word?
My kids most definitely aren't.
Mm.
But it's not just from me and my wife. They're very, very opinionated about what they think is right and wrong, their own opinions. And I've obviously had an influence on that, and so has my wife. And I'm talking about 13 to 16 years old,
right.
You know, and they've got real opinion. They loathe Cameron and the Tories. And it's at school as well, they talk about it, you know. And they're forming their own opinions, which is great, which is what you should do based on information that you get, you know, hopefully not too biased. And
it is going to be biased information though, isn't it?
If you're going to live in Chef, yeah, it's going to be slightly biased, yeah. Well, we just have a saying, if it in rate, what is it? Wrong.
Yeah.
The end, you know. You know, social justice and stuff like that are things that I consider to be really important, and it doesn't seem to be very important to them. To the Tories, you know, and governments in general, you know. But I think what's interesting is that Jeremy Corbyn and his colleagues have definitely sparked an interest in debate, political debate in young people, a lot more. And I think before he turned up on the scene, not that he's like Johnny Come Lately, because he's been a parliamentary MP for years. I mean, my youngest said something really wise. He said, "Dad, they're really afraid of him, aren't they?" And I said, "Yes, son." I said to him, "Why?" And he goes, "Because people don't expend that much energy," he's talking about the media, "in trying to make someone look like a buffoon unless they're afraid of him." Do you know what I mean? So they must be terrified of him, I think, to expend that much energy, because they control all the media as well, that much energy on trying to destroy somebody and ridicule him unless they were frightened of him.
Do you think he's got the chops to be Prime Minister? Do you think that could ever happen?
He drops, as we say, the odd colossal bollock, you know. And he might be John the Baptist rather than the Jesus character that this country needs, you know. So somebody quite politically evangelical, I think, to really look towards people rather than just commerce, you know. I'm no fortune teller, but, you know, is Tony Blair broke my heart, you know, completely with what he did and what he promised and where we could have gone, and a lot more hopeful and equal, better society. And he took us into the jaws of the monster, you know. I'm 49 now, and I'm pretty cynical about politicians. And I think cynicism, and I don't mean it as in I'm just sneering at everything. I don't mean that. There's a certain aspect of self-preservation of being slightly cynical, you know. The proof will be in the pudding, as they say. It's yet to be seen. I wish him the best, and I hope that even if he doesn't make Prime Minister, what's interesting is I think that it's opened the concept of debate from opposing sides. That's what democracy is supposed to be. And I, you know, you couldn't put a Rizzler paper between David Cameron and Tony Blair or any of the other Miliband and all them. You just couldn't. You know, it's basically the same political elite that are what they're debating. Nothing. Oh, I agree with you. I agree with you. You know what I mean? He's so extreme. Not extreme, but in comparison to them,
yeah.
He now seems really extreme. But he's nothing compared to a lot of the men I knew and the women, political activists in Sheffield when I was younger. You know, he's quite moderate compared to them, you know.
One of my favourite moments of the last, or since he's been leader of the Labour Party, was I think the first Prime Minister's questions.
Oh yeah, when he asked him to be polite.
Yeah.
Let's and, not do all screaming and bawling. Yeah.
Yeah, and when they were all barracking him, and he just looked at them like totally disapproving, and it quietened the room. I thought that was brilliant. But back to
I agree, because it's that's uncivilized. You listen to him; it sounds like listening to a zoo.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's not what you want, is it? In charge of the country.
No, because you think, well, me personally, I mean, I don't know, people might find it entertaining, but if you've just got them behaving like what I would imagine Bedlam was like. It's what it's like loads of lunatics, you know, and you're thinking these people are making decisions that are going to shape our lives, and they can't actually even have a civil discussion with each other. So I'm glad that he did that, and I mean, it hasn't stopped him, because they're still the same, you know, animalistic people, you know.
Yeah.
Those people, they've got nothing in their souls, and they make our TVs blind us from our vision and our goals. Oh, the trigger of time, it tricks you, so you have no way to grow. Do you know that tonight the streets are ours? It's tonight. The streets are ours. And these lights in our hearts, they tell no lies.
This is quite comical. I don't know whether no one's actually seen this, but we're in a room that only just has lights.
Yeah, this is
every 5 minutes you have to get up and turn. Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to put that on.
Is that it, do you think?
Yeah, and then, well, at least we've got some actual light. You heard the the flick of the switch.
Again, I think we maybe covered this slightly back to music. Your mum was a singer, your dad was a guitarist. Your uncle, Frank White, was also a guitarist.
He played Kung Fu regularly.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I used to play with him.
Yeah, I think actually you might have played here with him.
At the Bath Hall?
Not the Bath Hall, but Lincoln Imp, I think.
Yeah, that was it, something like that. I remember...
You'd be quite young at this
point. Oh, yeah, maybe 18, 19, something like that, maybe 20. I played with him for on and off my whole teens, very early teens. And, yeah, he used to come to Scunthorpe a lot.
Did all that exposure to music, to being on stage and stuff, did that point to possibilities, or was it just a kind of excursion, if you like? A bit
of a distraction? Oh, no, it was very early on that I said to myself... Well, the alternative, I got the best alternative for me. You know what I mean? I'd got a way out of standing in the dole queue that I could entertain people and play on stage and play my guitar. And like I said to you before, I'm, you know, incredibly grateful that happened in my life. You know, so a lot of my mates I went to school with have not had very happy lives, you know, still friends with them and stuff, you know. And.
Do you think they feel a sense of envy towards you because you got out? And do you feel a sense of guilt or responsibility towards them?
No, not at all. There's none of that nonsense.
Good.
They've still been. I'm still friends with kids I used to go to school with. You know, the plumbers, decorators, whatever. You know, I mean, I don't want to paint this bleak, miserable. You know, that they some of them haven't had good lives as a result of them. The issue is choice, isn't it? You can choose to do what you want to do, and you know. In post-industrial Sheffield, the word choice was not on the menu, you know what I mean? So, you know, and it wasn't like I'd got like a silver spoon in my mouth. It was a long time and I had to be really committed to what I was doing. And, you know, I decided I wanted to... I've been playing guitar since I was a kid, so I was already a musician, but I wanted to be a professional musician that earned his living. Whatever that may be, playing in wine bars or whatever, working men's clubs, which I was doing with Frank and my dad, that was enough. Do you know what I mean? And as it happened, the weird sort of twists and turns of fate, I ended up being what I am. But it took a long time. You know, from being 16 to 26, that 10-year period, you had to, it was like hanging onto a cliff edge, you know.
With only that 20 quid a week to save.
Yeah, of course, you know, and then I'd busk, because we'd get on the train, me and a couple of my mates, and we'd go to Doncaster or Leeds or wherever, because you couldn't busk in Sheffield, because if you did, you'd get done, you know. And yeah, we used to, you just busk. If you couldn't eat and you couldn't afford to, or there wasn't enough work, you just get on the train and go and busk. I find that quite honest to myself, because it's not, you know, it's, people don't like what you're doing, just walk on by, you know.
In this age of close connection between an artist and his audience, there's none closer than that, is there?
No, it's about as close as it gets, especially if you're busking at Christmas. Yeah. Like to get a half-empty can of lager at the back of your head, you know, as well. Your trouble, yeah.
What was the music in your house? What did your family listen to when you were growing up?
I mean, it constantly changed, you know, it wasn't... One, you know, the kids always bring their own music into the house. You know, my eldest boy, he's really into reggae and that. He's bringing some great stuff into the house now. And my youngest is a drummer, so he's just listening to loads and loads of Latin and mad hip hop stuff and that. So he's just really into. He's a great player already. He's only 13. And yeah, I mean, Mum liked a lot of very traditional bluegrass harmony singing, Delmore Brothers, Everly's. And the like, you know, yeah. And folk music. My mum was definitely the gentler end of the spectrum, I would say. And Dad's stuff was rock and roll.
Mm.
You know, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, early Elvis, well, Elvis, Jerry Lee, all the Sun stuff, Chess records, you know, and Little Walter and Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and all that. It's fantastic.
Well, we're roughly the same age, give or take a year. Because you've got a well-documented appreciation of artists from outside of your era, traditional growing up era, let's say.
I still like them, though, you know.
Yeah, but what was going on in contemporary terms? Because you have covered some Candy Talking by Jesus and Mary Chain.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess alternative rock, more interesting stuff.
I mean, at heart, I'm an indie kid, you know, early 80s indie kid. I was in Tree Bound Story, you know, we got signed to Fond Records and put John Peel loved us and all that, you know. But yeah, parallel to that, there was a lot of the roots and more traditional stuff that was home, you know.
Mm.
And when it came to kind of doing my own thing, all that bedrock of stuff that I'd absorbed like a sponge from being a kid, that was the biggest influence. And the thing that I felt, well, it's a mix, you know. I mean, there's a lot of what I do. I listen to a lot of psychedelia and 60s stuff like that, and that had a powerful effect. So it's kind of a big melting pot of music, you know. And a song is a song, you know, it's either good or bad, or it moves you or it doesn't, you know. And genres and all that, the older I get, I just think, well, it's a waste of time, you know.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
When you are in love, or you feel the stars above, there's no devil in her eyes, there's no darkness in disguise. But when you are alone, a kiss can turn your heart to stone. Hearts breaking in the night, there's a devil in her eyes. Oh, it's serious, so serious. A kiss that caught the wind made you delirious. Oh, it's serious, so serious. Take her in your arms, don't be afraid. Never be afraid.
I remember you on stage a few years ago recounting this tale, correct me if I'm wrong. You played your dad one of your new songs when he was on his deathbed. And he listened to it and took a moment and then told you, and this is a wonderful phrase, that you were soft as a bag of tits.
Yeah, yeah.
What was your relationship with him like?
Dad, he was great. You know, he was, you know, my dad had quite a hard life. You know, it was really hard being brought up in Darnell and Pittsmore and all that when, in the 50s and 40s, you know. It was hard, really hard. But he was so gentle. And funny as well, really, really funny. and all my uncles were just, they could make a cat laugh, you know, my granddad, they were just hilarious men. Dad was a great, mum, you know, as well, they were really just very typical working class Sheffield people. He was really inspiring, my dad. You know, he'd work 14 hours sometimes a day in the steelworks doing overtime and that. And then he'd come back and spend as much time as he had with me on the guitar. And then he'd get in the bath and have his tea and then go out and play with his band at night. Mm. And that's a different... It'd kill me, that. 20 plus years of doing that every night, you know. As they say, a different class. Because I certainly couldn't handle it. But he was a good guy. And like all people, he had his faults. He liked his ale. You know, his first job was a bookie boy at Steelworks.
Right.
Which is the steelworkers used to have a beer allowance, which was, I think, about 14 pints a week, something like that.
Which is, in Sheffield terms, not that much.
Not that much. It's an afternoon out. But you saw Port Wall with a bucket, and it had a chain and attached it with a tankard. And one of the blokes would be stripped to the waist, banging this pig iron, you know, molten pig iron. And then they'd just say, go on, son, I'll have my beer allowance now. And they'd neck, toss off 6 or 7 pints, and then carry on work. I mean, health and safety won't have it now. But it's why a lot of men in Sheffield of that time were big drinkers, because it used to, well, like water off a duck's back, you know. It depends on your outlook on life. I mean, I've never had particularly problems with that, you know. Especially they were so funny, you know, and they lived really, really hard lives. But I just remember laughing a lot, just lots, you know.
That sense of humour that's run through your music and your onstage persona, that's obviously where that came from. But also the integrity of the music itself, but of the hard work. Obviously, that's a reflection of where it is that you're from. Looking back over your solo stuff, have you achieved what you've wanted to achieve, or does that kind of thinking just come on a song-by-song basis as a writer rather than as a career overview?
Yeah, that's a real journalistic question.
Are you happy with the way things are?
Oh, it's not exactly a nightmare, is it? No. It's playing to human beings who turn up and come and watch us. That was always the main thing for me, because I never wanted to just play to the cool kids. You know what I mean? It was just, if you're a human being, you can come and not have any of that nonsense, which I'd been involved or artists I'd worked with before. It was very specifically targeted at a specific audience, you know.
Kind of an exclusive thing.
Yeah, a lot of the indie stuff was like that was it. And it was indier than thou. And that always used to piss me off a bit, you know. And the music is about communication of a feeling or an idea, a mood or, you know, all that. It's not necessarily something that's just supposed to be kind of exclusive to one facet of society. And that always...
just becomes a loop, doesn't it? A feedback loop.
Yeah, that's it. And you're not really going to go anywhere. And I'm amazed at the breadth of age groups and race and gender and the people that come and see us. Do you know what I mean? And it is, I'm really proud of that, actually. That it's a non-exclusive kind of thing, you know. And we're not too cool for school, you know. That was something I wanted to achieve, which has been achieved. But I guess, really, I mean... when I first made my first solo record, it was kind of in part to shut people up. My mum, my dad, dear friends, you know, like Jarvis and Steve Mackey from Pull were always encouraging me. It was kind of, the encouragement was starting to turn into nagging because I was getting older and I'd still not done it. You know, my dad gave me some great advice. He said, son, you don't want to get to be 60 and look back and go, bugger, I didn't do it. Do you know what I mean? And that really resonated with me. I thought, that's right. That I've got to give it, not to make it all that rubbish, was just to make some music of your own that belonged to you and you could share with other people. That was something that was really fundamentally important to me, you know. It's just carried on, really, and got a bit, I guess the word bigger, or there's more people turn up, you know, that. But I'm still the same person. It has not changed me, you know, at all. And well, I've grown, but I don't mean change in the negative sense of the world. I'm still not interested in the swimming pool in LA. I really, all that is just as far away from what I want to achieve as possible, you know. And it's just to keep communicating with people. sounds so simple, but it's not a simple task to keep doing.
Mm. Well, Hollow Meadows, the latest record, is another example of you at your best, I think.
Thank you.
Particularly the first couple of singles. We played in with Heart of Oak and we'll play out with I Still Want You in a moment. But after this tour and this record, what's next? You gave me a little clue, actually, before we started recording, that you're going to take some family time out and a road trip. But what is next for you?
I don't really know. What amazes me is the kind of twists and turns and the meanderings that, I won't call it a career, I became a musician to avoid having a career. I've said that before, you know. it's being a musician, just like, yeah, to avoid all that, you know. Just sit and play a guitar. And I've never had a job. I worked for 6 weeks once in HMV, and I've never had a job. I'm right lazy. I've never really made plans, you know what I mean? It's just sort of happened, you know, the people that I've worked with, and I've never chased it, ever. You know, my manager's like that, Graham, and we've known each other for 32 years, and he's the same. The phone rings and something interesting seems to happen. So, good music finds its own friend. It's like ink in water. You don't need all the hype. It'll get there, but it might be a bit slower.
Richard, thanks very much for your time. It's been really interesting to talk to you. Good luck with the rest of the tour and everything. And we're going to play out with I Still Want You. So in your own words, let's ballad.
Sorry I've been away so long. I needed just a little more time. If you stare through the glass from moment to moment, it's funny what you find. Now I think I'm almost ready to step back into your frame. We can move our bodies like a twist of smoke. Come let us shake like the flames. Now I don't want to lower the tone, but you know there's still a little spare meat on the bone. Oh, I still want you. Oh, I still want you. Oh, I still want you. Until the sun grows cold, no need to breathe all alone. Under the stars is a sweet hollow meadow where the lost things are found. Under the stars is a sweet hollow meadow where all of us are bound. I don't want to lower the tone, but you know there's still a little spare meat on the bone. Oh, to breathe all alone.
www.themouthmagazine.com.